Have you ever noticed that sometimes winning feels like losing? I mean, we all know the Bible's storyline. How does it end? God wins. No doubt about it. God is triumphant. No doubt about it. And so are all of those who belong to Him. We win because God wins. Do you really believe that's true? Do you really believe that all of those who are on the side of God will win with God? If so, then why is it that winning so often feels like losing? I mean, we know that we're on the winning team, but often it feels like we're on the losing team. Listen, if this is what winning is like, I'm glad I'm not on the losing team. What am I referring to specifically? Cancer. So many other physical ailments, financial hardship, family heartache, broken relationships, unexplainable tragedies, professional disappointments. The list goes on and on. So let me ask, are you familiar with disappointment in this life? How about discouragement? How about despair? Are you familiar with anxiety, stress, pressure, especially when it seems to be coming upon you from all sides? Are you acquainted with any of that stuff? To be honest, I mean, by this time in our lives, we've come to assume it. So that's my question this morning. If God wins, and if all of those who are on the side of God also win, then why does winning so often feel like losing? You see, beloved, that's exactly the question that Joseph is asking himself in our chapter. It wasn't that long ago when a look at Joseph's life seemed to be that he was in position for great success. There was that multicolored robe that was given to him as a gift from his father that pictured his exaltation over all of his brothers. And then, of course, there were the dreams given to him by God himself that was a foretaste of authority that Joseph was going to have in his life. And then, of course, there was the covenant promises that were given to his family, to his grandfather Abraham, his great-grandfather, his grandfather Isaac, his father Jacob, that through Joseph's family, all of the families in the world would be blessed. What a great and glorious future if you're part of the covenant family. If anyone ever had a rosy future, it was Joseph. But as we come to chapter 39, we remember that he was carted off, last we saw him, as a slave to a foreign land, and now he's being sold to the highest bidder. Is this really what winning looks like? He's the victim of human trafficking, of a foreign slave in a foreign land. No doubt he can't even understand the language that's being spoken all around him. And you could picture this really boy cowering in fear as he wonders what's going to happen next and concerned about an unknown future. Everything has gone so terribly wrong in Joseph's life. I really doubt that he feels like a winner at this point. So why is it that winning so often feels like losing? Well, as we come to our chapter this morning, we're going to find some answers to that most perplexing question. And let me let you know something about this chapter up front. It's a literary masterpiece. It's been strategically placed here and put together by Moses. And it's especially important for us to know this as we make our way through the story. There's three paragraphs, and the opening paragraph and the closing paragraph are almost exact parallel images. Now, remember that. It's important for us to understand. In a sense, they serve as literary bookends to help us understand the entire chapter. Why does Moses do this? Simple. To help us understand the dark middle paragraph, which these two bookend chapters surround. You see, it's in this chapter that Moses, he's going to tell us what we already know, that yes, life is filled with all kinds of disappointment. And he's going to answer the question for us, why is it that winning believers, the covenant family, why is it that it so often feels like losing? So let's go through the three paragraphs individually. First paragraph, let me give it this title, The Blessing of God's Presence. Verse 1. Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an Egyptian officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the bodyguard, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. This verse here kind of serves as a bridge connecting us to chapter 37, going right over chapter 38. You remember in chapter 37, Joseph, the last verse, chapter 37, Joseph is sold. First verse, chapter 39, Joseph is bought. We also have a change of geography. We have moved from the glory of the promised land, and now we're in the dark land of Egypt. Well, we have moved from the rural farmland of Canaan to the urban city life of what is probably the greatest nation, greatest city in the world, the greatest superpower. Here we are in the heart of the Nile Valley. Picture Joseph under the shadow of the great pagan pyramids, and he is sold as just another piece of cattle. And when this humiliating ordeal is finally finished, he is taken to what is no doubt the very plush estate of one of the most powerful men in all of Egypt. His new owner's name is Potiphar. His title? He is the captain of Pharaoh's bodyguard. His nationality, as you would expect, he is an Egyptian. He is the head of an elite unit of men that protect the Egyptian Pharaoh, who is the most important and most powerful man in the world at this time. We might say that Potiphar is the head of Pharaoh's secret service. And in our story, he finds himself with another slave, a Hebrew boy named Joseph. And I guess we ought to ask this question. What about God? I mean, where is God in all of this? I think it's an appropriate question because Joseph is part of the covenant family. And we've already found ourselves asking this question back in chapter 37. I mean, where was God when Joseph's brothers were disputing over how they were going to dispose him? Where was God when Joseph's brothers sat down and coldly ate a lunch while he sat in a deep pit of a prison next to them? Where was God when Joseph was tied to a wagon and dragged off to the faraway land of Egypt? Throughout the entire chapter of 37, throughout all of the abuse that Joseph endured, God is never mentioned even once. You remember that? It's kind of how we feel sometimes in our lives, right? When disappointments begin to drown us, when they begin to flood us as wave after wave after wave, we wonder to ourselves, where is God in all of this? Does he know? That's exactly the question we were left asking at the end of chapter 37. So let's ask it again as we come to chapter 39. Where is God in relation to his covenant child Joseph? Well, verse 2 gives us the answer. The Lord was with Joseph. That answers the question that was so conspicuous in our minds in chapter 37. And by the way, Moses repeats it 4 times in this chapter. Twice in the opening paragraph, twice in the closing paragraph. The Lord was with Joseph. The Lord was with Joseph. Joseph may be miles detached from the promised land, but God is not tied down to a piece of geography. I would tell you that it's more than just the omnipresence of God, but it's more a picture of what we have throughout the book of Genesis, and that is the relationship that God has with his covenant people. I think the great illustration is what happened to Jacob a few years back when he was leaving the promised land, fleeing from his vengeful, murderous brother Esau. And just as he's about to flee the promised land, the Lord appears to him on top of a ladder in heaven. And you remember Joseph said in Genesis 28 and verse 16, "Surely the Lord is in this place, but I didn't know it." We might call this the promise of God's covenantal companionship with his people. Whether or not you ever see me, whether or not you can ever hear me, whether or not you are conscious of me, I am always with you, sometimes spectacularly, most times unobtrusively, but ever working behind the scenes on your behalf. So here we are in chapter 39. And despite all that's taken place in Joseph's life, all the disappointment, all the pain, all the heartache, where do we find the God of Joseph? And the Lord was with Joseph. And listen, not just with Joseph, but with Joseph to bless Joseph. Verse 2, so he, Joseph, became a successful man. The success expresses itself in 3 ways. Let me show you. Number 1, the end of verse 2. He was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. Instead of being relegated to some outside slave task in Potiphar's fields with Potiphar's other slaves under the hot Egyptian sun, Joseph is chosen to work indoors in the plush estate of Potiphar. Number 2, verse 3. Now his master saw that the Lord was with him and how the Lord caused all that he did to prosper in his hand. So Joseph found favor in his sight and became his personal servant. I love that little phrase. It's the same phrase used of Joshua, who became the personal attendant of Moses. Same phrase used of Elijah, who became the personal attendant of Elijah. Joseph was promoted to being Potiphar's right-hand man. By the way, we would assume here that this implies that Joseph was the most responsible, industrious, hardworking servant that Potiphar had, all the while not compromising his loyalty to God, by the way. How do we know that? Well, it was so obvious Potiphar saw it. Again, verse 3, now his master saw that the Lord was with him and how the Lord caused all that he did to prosper from his hand. As Potiphar viewed this unusual success of Joseph, it told him everything he needed to know about Joseph's God. And please understand, the primary lesson here is not, then just go and be a servant like Joseph. Instead, the point the author is making is this. All the success that Joseph had was because of the sovereign blessing of God on his life. Again, that's the end of verse 3. It was the Lord who caused all that he did to prosper in his hand. We tend to view this story and think to ourselves that, you know, Joseph, he must have been a cut above the rest. I suspect he may have been. But that's not the point. The point is that God is determined to bless his covenant children. It was God who blessed Joseph. It was God who was with Joseph. It was God who prospered Joseph. It was God who caused Joseph to succeed. It was God who caused others to notice. All of that leads to Joseph's third promotion, the end of verse 4. And he made him overseer over his house, and all that he owned, he put in his charge. I want to tell you, this is absolutely amazing. And just to make sure we don't miss it, just watch. He repeats it again and again, verse 5. And it came about from that time that he, Potiphar, made him, Joseph, overseer in his house, and over all that he owned. And the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house on account of Joseph. Thus the Lord's blessing was upon all that he owned in the house and in the field, so that he left everything he owned in Joseph's charge. And with him there he did not concern himself with anything. So here Joseph has complete authority over the entire estate of the head of the Egyptian secret service. He is over everything. Except one thing, verse 6, except the food in which he ate. Now, I find that a bit strange. I mean, why is Joseph in charge of everything but not the food? Why the food? And my initial thought was, well, it was all about protecting Potiphar from assassination, and you don't give Joseph access to the food because he might poison the food and take Potiphar's life. I tell you, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense in my mind. In light of the fact that Potiphar trusted Joseph with everything else he had. In fact, I would put it this way, that Joseph was the man that Potiphar trusted more than anyone else in this world. So why is that there? Why the food? We're going to find out in a few moments. But up until this point, let me just say this. This is the opening paragraph. And what it does, it kind of winds up chapter 37, and it articulates for us both the blessing, the presence and the blessing of God in the life of the child of God. And to be honest with you, after so much suffering, after so much mistreatment, it finally feels like winning. I mean, this is the kind of life that you would expect every child of God to have, right? I mean, after all, are we not on the winning team? I mean, it only makes sense that for those who belong to God, that everything just works out perfectly in their lives, right? And here we have Joseph as a great example. I mean, yes, he's experienced disappointment. Yes, he has experienced mistreatment and heartache. But here we are in the end, and everything just turns to gold. The fact is, as we move to the second paragraph, this is exactly what comes back to haunt Joseph. He has maybe one gift too many. I've entitled the second paragraph, "The Painful Consequences of Living in a Sinful World." Look at the end of verse 6. Now, Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. Obviously, it was in the genes, because the only other one in the Bible that this phrase is used is Joseph's mother, Rachel. Genesis 27 and 28 and verse 17, Rachel was beautiful in form and in appearance. Listen, there's nothing inherently wrong with that. Nothing inherently wrong with being handsome, beautiful, in form and appearance. I mean, my question is, why mention it here? I mean, who really cares that this slave is an extremely handsome young man? Well, Moses places the information here about Joseph's appearance because it becomes kind of the pivot upon which the entire story is turned upside down. Up until this point, everything in Joseph's life recently seemed like he was winning. So who did care that Joseph was a handsome man? Verse 7, it came about after these events that his master's wife, Potiphar's wife, looked with desire at Joseph, and she said, "Lie with me." Now, here's what I want you to see. This isn't an invitation to intimacy, but it's an abuse of authority. That's the idea here. She speaks only two terse words in the Hebrew language, and they have nothing to do with love. They have everything to do with power. This is a demand on a part of a superior over an inferior. This is the classic case of sexual harassment. I mean, what we have is a person in position of power who is seeking to use that power to obtain sexual privileges. And might I venture a guess here? Joseph isn't the first young man that she's exercised this authority over. I mean, you look, there is no affection here. There is no fondness here. There is no friendship here. There is nothing but pure lust and the authoritative demand to get what she wants. This is an authoritative demand. Let's ask this question. Who is Mrs. Potiphar? Let me try to paint a bit of a portrait for us. She is the belle of the ball. That's who she is. She is a spoiled wife of a wealthy and powerful man who is used to getting everything and anything she wants. The clothes she wears, only from the most high-priced stores. Her jewelry, top of the line. No doubt she's been on the cover of Egypt's Cosmopolitan magazine. She is well known in all the social, elite, sophisticated circles in Egypt. Manicures, pedicures, tanning salons, the latest and most up-to-date hairstyles. She is the envy of every Egyptian woman. And with Potiphar as her bankroll, well, she is living the most luxurious of lives. Nothing is out of her reach. Whatever she wants, she gets. But when you kind of airbrush away all of the facade, what we see in our story is she is a most sad and tragic figure. You see, it's her and not Joseph who's the real slave in our story. She is a well-respected woman, but she is a slave to her own lust. Verse 7, again, it came about after these events that his master's wife looked with desire at Joseph and said, "Lie with me." She's in bondage to her own illicit desires. But not Joseph, by the way. Verse 8, but he refused. Now you have to imagine this didn't go over well with Mrs. Potiphar. In fact, I'm not sure that there were very many people in her life that had the nerve to tell her no. We're going to see in a bit that even her most powerful husband did not have that nerve. But Joseph resisted. Joseph refused. That's real freedom. You see, real freedom is not I get to do what I want to do. Real freedom is I get to do what God wants me to do. That's real freedom. Let me address it for us theologically. Because she is an unbeliever, Mrs. Potiphar cannot not sin. Apart from the grace of God in her life, she has no ability to consistently resist the sinful desires of her flesh. So don't let her expensive clothes trick you. Don't let her sophisticated style fool you. She's the slave in our story. For she has no ability to say no to her own sinful inclinations. Despite all of the expensive exterior, she is a pathetic woman in our story. For she cannot say no to her own fleshly desires. You say, I thought Joseph was the slave. No, he's the free man. Because by the grace of God, Joseph is free to resist his own sinful inclinations. And if you think about it, Joseph is in a position where he would have had all kind of excuses to give. I've been away from home for so long and I'm just real lonely. You don't know what kind of dysfunctional home I've come from. You know, if you've read the book in Genesis, you'll find out. And certainly God wants me to be fulfilled. She was the one who pursued me. I didn't pursue her. She's my superior. What was I to do? She's a woman of great authority. I thought if I can get on her good side, maybe I'd secure my release. Hey, what's wrong with a little fun? How about this one? Lord, if you don't want me to, then you take away those illicit desires. Joseph had so many reasons to give in and let, yet he refused. How? Let me show you. He appeals three ways: to the ethical, to the relational, to the theological. Number one, the ethical appeal, verse 8. But he refused, and he said to his master's wife, "Behold, with me here, my master does not concern himself with anything in the house, and he has put all that he owns, in my charge." In other words, Joseph refuses on ethical grounds. "Potiphar, your husband has entrusted me with everything he owns." In fact, Joseph doesn't even refer to him as Potiphar. He refers to him as his master. And he's not going to violate the master-servant relationship, so he refuses on that ethical ground.